pain, exhaustion, illness, or all situations in which the body loses its daily familiarity. Apparently, not every experience is a daily lived experience or an experience of meaning, as phenology has it. The stress is not always on the lived immediacy of a centered subject. Experience can also provoke a loss of identity. Such a non-phenological account of experience can be found in Foucault's notion of limit experience, by which he attends an experience that tears the subject from itself, in such a way that it may arrive at dissociation. It has been suggested, for example by Drew Leader in The Absent Body, that experiences of dissociation encourage Cartesian dualism because they often result in an apparent cleavage of the self and the body. I will challenge this Cartesian mode of thinking through a brief discussion of Coetzee's novel Elizabeth Costello, in particular then lessons 3 and 4 of The Lives of Animals, because I think that literature and its open and polysemous language often give us more to think about than authors are aware of. In this case, the novel seems to reveal something crucial about the complexity of human corporality. In The Lives of Animals, Coetzee tells the story of a fictional Australian novelist, Elizabeth Costello, who is invited to give a lecture at Appleton College, an imaginary American university. Costello is haunted by a pervasive indifference to the terrible way in which we treat animals, a violence that she compares to the horror of the death camps during the Shoah. Coetzee's story has generally been understood as a way of confronting, within a fictional frame, the ethical issue of how we should treat animals. Peter Singer, for instance, takes Coetzee's story to be a way of presenting arguments for a kind of radical egalitarianism between human and non-human animals. In Philosophy and Animal Life, Cora Diamond has criticized Singer's position by asserting that the rights discourse somehow distorts and trivializes Elizabeth's experience of exposure by converting it into a philosophical problem about the moral status of animals. In her view, Costello is not just a device to put forward ideas about animal rights, rather she has a significance of her own. The wounded animal at the center of the story is Elizabeth Costello herself, and I quote, "If we see in the lectures a wounded woman, one thing that wounds her is precisely the common and taken for granted mode of thought, that how we should treat animals is an ethical issue, and the knowledge that she will be taken to be contributing or intending to contribute to discussion of it. But what kind of beings are we for whom this is an issue? Beings that are physically exposed to vulnerability and mortality, Diamond contends, but that rely on argumentation to deflect the difficulty of what it is to be a living that is an embodied animal. In short, humans are beings that are inclined to mistake the difficulty of philosophy, something which is difficult to substantiate, for the difficulty of reality, something which is resistant to our thinking it. For Diamond, the difficulty of reality has clearly something to do with our body. Elizabeth Costello is someone who refuses to speak within the tradition of philosophical argumentation. This is why she does not offer an argument in defense of vegetarianism, and it's also why she is quick to point to the inconsistency of the fact that she wears leather shoes and carries a leather purse. The imaginary of the show as well is part of her aversion for philosophical arguments. She knows that her talk of the Holocaust will offend and not be understood. Elizabeth does not want to weigh the difficulty of reality, but she wants us to see her as what she really is. In this respect, it is significant that Costello, at the beginning of her presentation, compares herself with Red Peter, the educated ape of Kafka's Tale Report to an Academy, and proclaims, "I'm not a philosopher of mind, but an animal exhibiting to a gathering of scholars a wound which I cover up under my clothes, but touch on in every word I speak." We should ask ourselves, what exactly is it that wounds this woman? Cora Diamond identifies this wound with a condition of human embodiment, that is, with a physical exposure to vulnerability and mortality. For Diamond, Coetzee's lectures ask us to inhabit our own body. They invite us to appreciate the difficulty of our bodily life, and it's precisely this recognition of our own mortality and vulnerability, as shared with other animals, which generates our ethical obligations towards them. In other words, we're able to extend our moral sensibility to non-human others, not because we think of them as bearers of interests or as right holders, but as fellow creatures. We immediately read into animals a sense of the human. We hear them speak our language, we give them a name, and so on. For Diamond, the question of the animal clearly requires an alternative conception of ethics to the one that we find in the rights tradition, one in which we do not deflect, but receive and even suffer our exposure to the world. In his essay Compatible Thinking, Stanley Cavell draws out two key implications from Costello's notation of ourselves as a wounded animal. He follows Diamond by arguing that Costello's woundedness is identifiable with the condition of human embodiment. Yet, he stresses that it has also something to do with the wound which is present, that is touched on in every word she speaks. To explain what he means, Cavell runs to Ralph Waldo Emerson's Self-Reliance. Every word Emerson hears or speaks is fated to express chagrin, because all the words he speaks or hears are in essence, to begin with, the loss of others, common bread. But what other words are they? To speak is in a certain sense to be victimized by what there is to say or feel to say. We inherit a language which is always already on the scene before we are, and this has profound consequences for what we often too hastily think of as our concepts. Language, in fact, is never absolutely singular. It is a social phenomenon that needs a certain generality in order to persist in time. Therefore, private languages inevitably falter on the edge of silence and incomprehensible. They are untranslatable and meaningless. And here we touch a small point. In order to make ourselves understandable, we have to rely on an impersonal language that makes ourselves substitutable. Language is unable to house absolute uniqueness. That this can make us feel chagrined is evident from the conversation between Costello and her son John in the first lesson, Realism. Despite her effort not to write like anyone else, Elizabeth has to accept that she's just an example of writing, an incest. But maybe there is a third type of woundedness which is crucial here as well. The title of the story, The Lives of Animals, is significant here. Following Cara Diamond, I take the ledges as being concerned with the wounded animal at the center of the story. Diamond interprets this woundedness as a physical vulnerability that we share with other non-human animals. This means that for her, the central character of the story is a wounded human animal. The question, however, is why Costello needs to conceal this wound under her clothes, and why she touches on it in every word she speaks. Cavell follows Diamond's reading, but believes that Elizabeth is marked by yet another wound, a linguistic one, that characterizes only human beings. Thus Cavell innovates two different kinds of wounds, fleshy wounds and linguistic wounds. Now the problem is that Costello seems to talk about one and the same wound. Again, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that wounds this woman? Let us turn to Elizabeth's own words. The more that I feel like Red Peter, I did not intend it ironically. It means what it says. I say what I mean. I'm an old woman. I do not have the time any longer to say things I do not mean. She's an animal exhibiting a wound. But exactly what kind of animal is she? What is the primary point of her reference to Red Peter? What does it mean to feel like Red Peter? Let us turn to Kafka's tale in order to answer this question. Red Peter was shot during a hunting expedition on the Gold Coast. He was hit in two different places, below the hip and in his cheek. The first wound was a severe wound and made him limp. The latter one was only a slight wound, but left a large red scar which gave him the name of Red Peter. After he was caught, Red Peter was put on a boat and locked up in a cage whose dimensions prevented him to stand up or sit down. He was forced to squat with his knees bent while the cage bars were cutting his flesh. Unfortunately, Red Peter has little or no remembrances of his suit, and he does not recall what it felt like being an ape. He is unable to give an account of the life he formerly led as an ape, like the Academy requested, but has to rely on evidence of others to tell the story of his capture. He only recalls that he had to fight through the thick of things in order to live. Imitating humans, he submitted himself to language, and it was language which gave him an orientation and a delimitation in the world of man. Yet this subjection to language made him also vulnerable to language. In fact, like all human beings, Red Peter bears a rather paradoxical relation to his name. The tragedy of his name is that what he is called, Red Peter, is indifferent to who he feels he is, and I quote, Red Peter, a horrible name, utterly inappropriate, which only some ape could have thought of, as if the only difference between me and the performance ape Peter, who died not so long ago and had some small local reputation, is the red mark on my cheek. Sometimes, Red Peter is also displaced by the way humans think. He is painfully aware of the fact that for nearly every human being, the domestication of wild animals is as a mere accepted background of life, while he is hounded by it. This becomes clear when he speaks of the female chimpanzee that waits for him when he comes home late at night from banquets, scientific receptions or social gatherings. He takes comfort from her as apes do, but he cannot bear to see her by day because she has the insane look of the bewildered, half-broken animal in her eye. No one else sees it, but he does, and he cannot stand it. This hauntedness isolates him, and to a certain extent, Red Peter will always remain an anomaly among human beings, if solely for the unfamiliar figure of his body. In the presence of visitors, Red Peter has a predilection for taking down his trousers to show them the shot wound in his hip. For him, there is nothing indecent about it, and he does not understand why some writers have found a pretext in it to argue that his ape nature is not yet fully under control. And I quote, "I can take my trousers down before anyone I like. You would find nothing but a well-groomed fur in a scar. Everything is open and above board. There is nothing to conceal." Yet, why then does he hide the scar beneath human clothing? In this respect, it may be significant that seeing people is often repugnant for him. Not because he has an aversion to human beings in sea, but because they make him feel distant from the sense of his own bodily life. It may be clear that Red Peter is not an ordinary animal, but a wounded animal. Not because he was shot, these gunshot wounds healed, but because he stopped being an ape. Like other animals, apes are instinctively equipped for a specific environment. This means that their instincts give them a stable structure within which to operate so that they are not overwhelmed by the tensions and the challenges coming from their environment. This is why animals do not need to give meaning to their lives, and why they not really lead a life or have a biography in the sense that human beings have. Animals just live. This also explains why Red Peter does not have any recollection of his life as an ape previous to its capture. Now, the problem is that Red Peter cannot rely any longer on his animal instincts because the human smell has contaminated the smell of his native land. As a result, he has to seek for an alternative. It is language that gives him a way out. Yet language turns out to be more precarious than his former animal instincts. Moreover, there is something that seems to resist language. Words cannot help him to deal with the idea of the domestication of wild animals. If we start from the assumption that the animal at the center of his lecture is Elizabeth Costello herself, then we have to ask ourselves, again, what kind of animal is she? She is a wounded animal, not, or at least not solely, because of her physical vulnerability, as Diane contends, but because animality is no true option for her. This explains why Costello compares herself with Kafka's Red Peter and not with an ordinary animal. Moreover, like Red Peter, Elizabeth is haunted by something that her mind cannot encompass, namely the way in which we treat animals, and there is nothing that can help her to settle her attitude. Interesting in this respect is that Costello The Lives of Animals not only draws on Kafka's report on the Academy, but also on Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. In the final episode of his travels, Gulliver reaches the land of the Hunnimans, a race of super-rational horses, whose refinement contrasts drastically with the life of the Yahoos, naked and deformed human beings over which the Hunnims rule. Gulliver comes to both admire and emulate the cool reasonability of the Hunnims, rejecting humans as merely Yahoos and doubtless of representatives of reason. Yet, one day the assembly of the Hunnims decides that Gulliver, a Yahoo with some semblance of reason, forms a threat to their civilization, and he is expelled. Gulliver is then rescued against his will by a Portuguese ship that brings him back to England. Once home, however, Gulliver is unable to reconcile himself to living among the Yahoos. He becomes a recluse, avoiding his family and spending several hours a day speaking with the horses in his stables. Like Costello and Red Peter, Gulliver is displaced from his ordinary mode of thinking about the world. All three of them are cut out from their established language games because something has disrupted their pre-given structures of thought. This disruption strengthens their identity and their place in the world. What is even more important is that this isolation is felt in their bodies. Costello is an elderly woman who has problems with her heart and who has difficulty accepting the fact that she's growing older. Red Peter considers himself abnormal in the midst of ordinary human beings for the simple reason that he has a fur body and they don't. And also Gulliver forms an anomaly among the Hunnims because his body turns him into the regular, the one who does not fit. In other words, they all feel somehow disconnected from their bodies because their intentional engagement with the world is disturbed either by a change in the normal function of the body, as in the case of Costello, or by a change in the accepted paradigms of embodiment in the social milieu in which one lives, as in the case of Gulliver and Red Peter. In cases of dissociation as these, it is said that one comes to realize that one is not, in some deep sense, identical with one's body. The question is whether just a dualistic reading really captures the true character of these experiences. Let us explore a situation in which dissociation arises as a result of the fact that one has the wrong kind of body in a given social milieu and is discriminated because of it. The life stories of Gulliver and Peter are exemplary here. They are both treated in such a way that their existence as unique human beings is denied. They are turned into members of a species on the basis of their body. They are constantly made aware of their bodies and they are forced to experience themselves through a whole set of negative associations. As a young Gulliver is associated with raw meat and with the smell of excrement, and Red Peter is constantly reminded of his uncontrollable ape nature. As long as they were in their familiar environment, respectively among human beings and chimpanzees, Gulliver and Red Peter had little or no occasion to experience this bodily burden. It was only when they were confronted with the appearance of the so-called other that they were somehow turned into a mere body. Still, the question remains whether these experiences really make them think of themselves as essentially separate of their bodies. Gulliver and Peter are hurt because what they are called, a yahoo or an ape, does not correspond to who they feel themselves to be. Yet the pain that they feel does not solely come from denigratory speech, because every kind of name-calling disregards to some extent who someone is. In fact, the moment we want to say who someone is, our very vocabulary leads us astray to saying what he is. We get entangled in the description of qualities he necessarily shares with others, with the result that a specific uniqueness escapes us. Singularity will always exceed what one is called. Nevertheless, this linguistic vulnerability is a constitutive feature of one's uniqueness, because one is always uniquely verbal in different ways, to different worlds and at different times. The proper name Red Peter, for instance, does not designate a unique existence. Red Peter owes his name to resemblance with his name to his resemblance to the performance ape Peter and to the red scar on his cheek. Yet Red Peter is unique precisely because of this vulnerability to his name. He would not be who he is without it. His life story would be different. Likewise, the shock that Gulliver feels when the hoodlums banish him on the grounds that he is a yahoo gives him the sense that who he is does not coincide with what they claim him to be. Again, this vulnerability belongs to who he is because he would not be who he is without it. Gulliver and Red Peter may reject objective divine strictures that the hoodlums and the humans have given them on the basis of their bodily characteristics. They are not forced to recognize themselves in these corporal descriptions, yet that does not mean that they can separate themselves from their bodies. On the contrary, their body is still the point from which they perceive the world and by which they can act in the world and appear to others. So although Gulliver and Red Peter may feel estranged from their bodies due to the objective look of their antagonists, it does not follow from this that there is an important sense in which they are not their bodies. On the contrary, the experience of dissociation makes them aware of their particular embodiment as something that they cannot pull away. In other words, uniqueness has always something to do with a concrete embodiment. Dissociation is not always a result of the sudden appearance of the other. Even if one remains among one's equals, dissociation may arise. Elizabeth Costello, in fact, feels estranged, not because she is turned into a body by another, but because she is growing old. In the normal course of events, the body loses sight of itself in favor of the object of its engagement, that is, it tends to recede from direct experience. It is in a certain sense characterized by absence. However, in the event of inhibited intentionality, the smooth interplay of body and world is disrupted, and the body resurfaces in conscious experience. When one grows older, however, one's appearance and one's abilities undergo significant alterations. Therefore, greater attention is paid to the body, which is often experienced as an obstinate force interfering with one's projects. This is why Costello's body reveals itself as Unheimlich. It is no longer compliant with her life world. Yet, far from indicating a separation of self and body, this sense of uncanniness forces her to recognize the inescapability of her particular embodiment. The recognition of her corporality not only reminds her of her physical exposure to vulnerability and mortality, but also, and maybe primarily, of her irreducible singularity, insofar this uniqueness is a feature of her bodily existence. Nobody, in fact, can grow older or die in her place. In this sense, aging is almost a cruelly private experience. This is why Costello feels lonely. She is imprisoned by her own singularity, and she has a feeling of not belonging to the world at all. Now, if we understand what is the lives of animals in relation to our own lives, that's in relation to the lives of the animals we are, then what can be deduced from this all? Apparently, the body is intimately attached to ourselves. It has something to do with who we are, and this explains why we cannot put it away. Or still, the body symbolizes us. It renders us unique and irreplaceable. The singularity, this singularity is characterized by the exposure of being this and not another singular body, and has no other content than the irreducibility of this exposure, with the result that we never truly know who we are. Singularity is not something that we can grasp or possess, but rather something that possesses us. So although the notion of singularity is often bound up with existential romanticism and with a claim of authenticity, there seems to be no interior or inviolable core to it. Limited experiences as growing older expose us to a direct confrontation with our body uniqueness, which, because without content, unintelligible, and because unintelligible, threatening. This threat places upon the existential demand to reintegrate our body into a system of meaning where it becomes intelligible again. We owe the distinction between the uniqueness of every being, the who, and the collective identity which is common to many, to what, to Hannah Arendt. Uniqueness does not have to be confused with exceptionalness, which blesses only some. For Arendt, the uniqueness that testifies of our individuality is simply the fact that each of us is this and no other from birth. Uniqueness is not something that we possess in advance as an innate quality or inner self that we are able to master. The question of the who does not imply a response or a definition, but remains without answer. In For More Than One Voice, Adriana Cavallero, an Italian feminist philosopher who is deeply influenced by the work of Hannah Arendt, asserts that the who is an embodied uniqueness that is exposed in the voice. The voice, in fact, is a corporal element, and insofar each voice springs from a different throat, the voice is unique. In her more recent work, Horrorism, Naming Contemporary Violence, Cavallero has come to understand this body uniqueness in terms of vulnerability. By focusing on both the body and vulnerability, Cavallero's perspective departs somewhat from that of Arendt, because although these concepts are not entirely absent in her work, Arendt has not been particularly sensitive to them. Cavallero seems to develop her ontology of vulnerability and exposure more along the lines of Judith Butler's recent reflections on the notion of bodily vulnerability. Still, we should ask ourselves whether Butler and Cavallero are truly sharing the same vision. There is a certain ambiguity in Butler's theory on human vulnerability, because it is not always clear in what this vulnerability consists. There is, in fact, a certain confusion in her work between the notion of physical and linguistic vulnerability. And although they both function as a resource for ethics, they are far from being identical. In Excitable Speech, A Politics of Performance, Butler introduces the notion of linguistic vulnerability, and she argues that this vulnerability to language has something to do with the fact that we are constituted within its terms. This vulnerability to language exposes us to normative violence, that is, to the violence of particular social and cultural frames that determine who counts as cultural intelligible and who not. However, in Butler's more recent works, for example, in Precarious Life, the notion of vulnerability is rather understood in terms of physical vulnerability. And this physical, in the last work, she doesn't understand this vulnerability as linguistic, but rather as physical. And it is not always clear how they are connected. Because according to Butler, our common condition of physical or bodily vulnerability, which calls for a collective responsibility, has to be recognized. This means that the physical vulnerability is in a certain sense conditioned by our linguistic vulnerability, so by normative regulation.
Could you sort of close together now, because we already have
to. So I wanted to explain the difference between Cavallero and Butler, and then to explain my own position. So I will go to the last part. So I wanted to link the concept of corporal vulnerability with the notion of corporal singularity. And in this way, my perspective is more in line with that of Cavallero than with the one of Butler, who describes bodily vulnerability in terms of a physical dependency upon others. However, unlike Avery, I do not understand this vulnerability, or at least not primarily in terms of exposure. So it is not that I do not recognize the fact that the condition of corporal uniqueness consigns us to the alternative between the wound that the other can inflict us and the care that the other can provide us, which is what Cavarrieri is saying. But I think it should not be our sole focus, because there seems to be something more fundamental to our bodies, namely that being this singular body has no definitive content, and this indeterminateness makes us anxious. So when I understand bodily vulnerability rather than we are being exposed almost to our own bodies, still when I argue that the own body is uniquely vulnerable, I'm not making an essentialist claim. On the contrary, the ontology of corporal vulnerability is an emptied ontology, which does not focus on the water of identity but on corporal uniqueness. Such an ontology establishes dualistic modes of thinking and places us before another kind of vulnerability, which I will call a symbolic vulnerability. However, it is beyond the scope of this paper. So I want to conclude with returning to where we started. I'm an animal exhibiting a wound which I cover up under my clothes, but touched on in every word I speak. Considering what we have just said about corporal uniqueness, we can interpret Costello's assertion as follows. She's an aging woman who is left alone with the burden of her corporal singularity because she's unable to put this experience into words.
Thank you.